In this episode of CubeFM, we got a chance to speak to Harsha, who sheds light on some emerging Kubernetes tools, the intriguing concept of distroless container images, and why container security should be at the forefront of every developer's mind. He and I discussed the benefits of using distroless images, like their smaller size and reduced attack surface, while also tackling the myth that they're somehow inherently secure. Security, at the end of the day, is a continuous journey, and Harsha guides us through the best practices, from selecting base images to managing dependencies and fortifying every layer of your infrastructure. In addition to that, we'll also explore the supply chain as a potential attack vector, the importance of signing artifacts, and validating sources to keep your environment safe. And as a bonus, Harsha will share what drives him to share his knowledge, along with a sneak peek into his upcoming projects, including a new podcast and cutting-edge tool for simulating multi-stage attacks in cloud-native environments. This episode of CubeFM, sponsored by LearnK8s. How do you choose the best instance type for your Kubernetes cluster? Should you use few and very large instances, or small and mini? When using an 8GB 2V CPU instance, are all the memory and CPU available to pods? Is running the same Kubernetes node in AWS cheaper or more expensive than Azure and GCP? The Kubernetes Instance Calculator answers those questions and a lot more. The calculator is a free tool that lets you estimate costs for your workloads based on requests and instance sizes, explore instance overcommitment and efficiency, identify over and underspending by model error rates on your actual memory and CPU usage, compare instances between different cloud providers. It's an easy way to explore costs and efficiency before writing any line of code. You can find the link to the calculator in the comments. All right, Harsha, first things first. Which three emerging Kubernetes tools are you keeping an eye on?
All right, I don't have any specific tools in mind, but maybe I could think of Kiberno if it is run on Stride, or Kiberno for that matter. That's one good tool I came across. There's like regular tools like KubeAudit, KubeBench, KubeArmor, KubeScape to basically assess your clusters and find out maybe, you know, what are all the possible attack paths in the cluster. So Kiberno specifically, because it not just looks at your, it's not just like an admission controller which just uses validating and mutating webhooks, but it can also clean up resources. For example, think of a scenario where I directly spun up a resource by adding something into etcd, which is like a API server bypass, which is like an admission controller bypass. So in that case, maybe I can write, I can clean up resources which are, you know, not basically violating a policy which I had written in the Kiberno policy or so. It also helps me clean up resources. So yeah, I think that's a good tool. This is what I can think of.
Very good. With that in mind, you know, for people that don't know who you are, can you explain who you are, what do you do, where do you work?
All right, myself, Harsha Kaushik, and currently I'm a security researcher at Palo Alto Networks, mostly around CNAPP. So, maybe I started as a security engineer at a startup, and then I'd been there. I was doing cloud native security for a while, and then I've moved to Disney Plus Hotstar. There also, it's most more or less the same thing: infrastructure security, cloud, and cloud native. I just joined Palo. It's been 6 months. So this is a brief of what I do.
And how did you get into cloud native? What was that process like?
I would say it's all accident. I think the best things happen to us all by accident. And I've never planned that I'll get into infrastructure security as such. But my career started with networking, the typical CCNA, CCNP, routing and switching stuff back before I joined my college. After that, I just got introduced to, you know, how internet worked. It fascinated me. And yeah, then is when I got into the infrastructure security world. It started with cloud. It started with AWS. Then I learned Docker, KubeS, and other stuff like Linux, typical SOC, all these things. And post that, it's all, you know, I was exposed to CNAPPs. I mean, I have evaluated and I was in the POCs and basically got into a lot of calls, and we have bought I've used 3 CNAPs till date. So that's how all my work around was around CNAPs and, you know.
And the Kubernetes ecosystem moves very quickly. What do you do to stay on top of all the things that are going on? Which sources and resources are the best for you?
I think mostly any random newsletters. I mean, some of the security stuff, you know, basically Client Gibbler or somebody just keeps posting on Twitter. There's a lot of Twitter accounts. I don't recall them, but there's a lot of sources in Twitter to basically know what's happening. Apart from that, I think it's forums, you know, any of the forums, somebody keeps asking, hey, there's a new tool there out there. What are the capabilities if somebody had already tried it? So what is it, right? So then I just go and take a look at it. Mostly these, yeah.
If you could go back in time and give one career tip to your previous self, what would it be?
One career tip to myself. Maybe something like, I think, let's say, just go out, write, talk about everything you know, without you know, always having this, always, you know, something stopping you doing this, because you might think, hey, maybe this stuff is not that interesting, right? What do you know is not that interesting, right? So, but that's something which always stopped me, you know, 2 years back, that, you know, from writing or talking. But later I realized that, I mean, what I know right now is something what a 2 year or 3 year, you know, maybe younger folks actually want to exactly know the same thing, right? Let's say you figured it right, you figured it out now in the last 2-3 years, but they are in your state where you were in there, where you were in the last 2-3 years, right? So I think best way is to just go write down things, talk about things without, you know, without anything stopping you, because we keep learning a lot of things in the security world day in, day out, right? For you to even look back and see that what all you've learned and do a validation, right? It takes something like writing or talking about it. That's a great reminder for you to see that what all you've learned till now, right? So I think that thing, yeah.
Solid advice. It's great. Now, for, you know, the topic of conversation today in our monthly content discovery, we found an article that you wrote titled "Abusing a Distroless Container" based on your experience with a real incident. The questions that we want to, you know, be asking you will take this topic but just a little bit further. So the article that you wrote revolves around distroless containers. Taking a step back before diving into the episode's crux, if someone is a software developer who uses Docker build to build Docker images, what are distroless images and why should anybody care about them?
I think I've seen a video of this. I think there was a DEF CON talk, and also somebody wrote on Form 3, Daniel or someone. So that basically, I was just checking in my infra, are there distroless containers which have this same OpenSSL 1? And when I went and checked, there were, right? So I just went and saw what can I do with this. And then, you know, I thought like I can write it down too. So the whole myth around distroless, that everybody was going behind distroless containers because of its the size and, you know, slim attack surface or escort. That was a whole hype about distroless. The thing they call like distroless, and what keeps it different from distro is just few things. A distro is a distro because it has its own, you know, it has a package manager, it has a shell, it has got its own OS level utils, or, you know, different kind of dependencies. That's what keeps a distro, right? So what, you know, let's say if you are specifically writing an application where, you know, we have seen in the past the multi-stage builds where all the tools which are used to build a container are just removed once the build is done, because you don't need them in the runtime. Just to ensure your container startup time is good, it is efficient, and a lot of other things, right? Same thing goes with distroless, where your focus is that whatever is needed for the application, whatever libraries are needed exactly with the application, I just need them, and I don't want any other OS level dependencies, package manager, shells. So this essentially basically strips down a lot of things and ensures the container size is very, you know, very minimal in size. Maybe 20-30 MB, depending on what you add. So yeah, in brief, this is a distroless image.
And what's not to love about smaller container images? It takes less time to build them and less time to push them to a registry. I also imagine that scaling a cluster is also quicker since downloading images takes less time. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, of course. I think if you look from a developer perspective, all they need is efficient containers, which can, let's say, if this spike in the traffic, the containers that they want their pods to be scaled in no time, right? Let's say from 50 to 500, it has to go in like the next 2 minutes. In that case, if you have a heavy container running, for your container to be, even if it is cached, it still takes for it to come up and basically load the application up and bring it up. So if the container is as minimal as possible, the start time, the space it takes in your registries like ECR, and also the pull time, that significantly gets reduced. So from a developer angle, that's a statement we should agree on.
If someone is a security conscious individual or company, should they consider using distroless, as fewer binaries probably means less chance of getting hacked?
Yes. Because the simple fact we'll have to remember is less number of binaries, less number of libraries is equals to less number of vulnerabilities, because newer library adds functionality. At the same time, it adds in more vulnerabilities as well, right? So fewer the binaries and libraries you have, fewer the vulnerabilities. Security should definitely consider using it. But it does not, there's a myth around this that distroless are the secure containers, but it is not, right? Because you still have certain libraries lurking around. So even those can be hacked. Just removing a shell does not mean you're safe, right? So.
Good point. But I guess let's ask it in a different way. If someone's image doesn't have a shell, they can't attach it to the running container and debug it. In a similar way, an attacker gaining access to the container won't be able to poke around. Isn't that right?
So if you look at shell in a container or any in general, shell is, I think, after GUI, the next most easiest way to interact with a system, right? So shell is like a abstracted couple of abstraction levels. Essentially, it is a couple of binaries, which is making certain system calls, right? So the same system calls are also made by your application libraries and functions. The same kind of system calls are made. So just removing shell might make it harder for an attacker to basically, do what it does with a shell. Does not mean that he can't do anything without a shell, because if the same level system calls, if could pull off with a certain different library, it's the same thing he's able to do, because end of the day, his motive is getting, So removing a shell itself does not mean that you are safe from executing all the commands.
So with that in mind, are distroless images convenient primarily for size and less for security?
I think it's both. Size, definitely. Security also, because if you look at a normal distro container like Alpine, Debian, though it has a lot of OS level dependencies, package managers and stuff, it is just this, that it has more libraries versus a distroless has less libraries. So you are cutting down on the attack surface, definitely yes, but you can't call that it is, secure container and you can't relax. You can't be like, you can't take it for granted that I'm using distroless, so I don't need to worry. That's not a true statement. So
most of the benefits you mentioned can also be found, and as you said, in Alpine-based images, which are much more secure thanks to music. So why even bother with distroless then?
I think the thing with Alpine again is there was that hype of Alpine where I think a few years back a lot of people were using Alpine as a hype around it. I think simple thing, Alpine, what it did was we have GNU libc where Alpine came up with Muzzle C, if I'm pronouncing it right. So it is basically a stripped down version of GNU libc, and certain implementations were rewritten. So it is essentially doing the same. The direction is also distroless, but it is also it is retaining its distro aspects. But it is having a package manager, it is having a shell, it is having OS level dependencies and all these things. But it is ensuring that the container size stays less, right? But over the time, I think we have seen a lot of issues with Alpine as well. Like, there's an article on how there was DNS resolution issues in Alpine. And I think there's also an article on how memory allocation is done differently in Alpine. They use the best fit allocation memory model where it tries to basically, I mean, it affects the heap because it tries to allocate the largest chunk possible at a single go, and it leaves a lot of gaps in the heap. So there's an article on that. So yeah, I mean, if you are trying to bring down the container size by making the system kind of a bit instable, I don't think it's the right way to do it, right? Instead, maybe you can look at a way where the container should be stable, as you know, as good as you're using a full-fledged OS. At the same time, it should be having less attack surface. Now, ChainGuard came up with things like Wolfie or, you know, these kinds of images, right? Maybe something like that.
Can we take this to the next level? Let's see. If someone really cares about security, shouldn't they use empty containers? And why does someone need a base operating system like Alpine or, you know, Debian in the first place? Empty means to binaries, no problem. Isn't that right?
I think if a developer exactly knows what it's doing, maybe then, like, you know, using empty container, and if, you know, he could pull all the libraries in for his system to be stable, then it's okay. But if you do not know, you know, what you're doing, going with empty scratch containers might be a problem, because let's say if you're missing on CSRs, or let's say there's no etc password file, or there's no basically, you know, time zone, there's no time zone defaults, like you will fail on logging, you'll fail on a lot of things, right? Even like this cron jobs and a lot of things depend on the time zone info. So if these things are missing in scratch, then you might have a hard time having all these things. So that's why they try to use certain, you know, certain kind of distro where basic stuff are there. At the same time, they can run their applications. So
we started off the podcast speaking about distroless and have now mentioned, you know, Alpine and Scratch. Are there any other base container images that allow, that follows the same philosophy and can help folks, you know, keep their size down while still helping them maintain their security posture?
I think, as I mentioned, I've come across ChainGuard's Wolfie image, and there's one more from Ubuntu. I've not used it. I think it's called Chelsea or something. So yeah, these images, they ensure that they are like production standard builds. At the same time, I think ChainGuard also claims that it's a zero CV image, but I don't know if I don't think that's the right metric of saying that a container is completely secure. But still, compared to other distro is containers, I think Wolfie is doing a great job. So maybe you can consider using Wolfie.
And it seems like, you know, in terms of takeaways from this conversation for our audience, security doesn't really seem to be something that you can turn on or off, but rather a continuous practice in which you basically have to invest a significant amount of time and effort. Now, you showed us how to exploit distroless container images, which are supposed to be secure. What would be the advice to our listeners who might not use distroless, but still want to secure their images?
I think securing containers is not just about securing containers. Like I always bring up this where I see infrastructure in seven layers, right? There is a CDN layer, there is cloud layer, there is clusters, there is compute, you're both server and serverless, and there is containers, and there is code. And underlying all these layers, there is compliance, where each layer of these should be compliant to various, you know, frameworks and benchmarks. So when you mean securing a container, it just does not mean that you are securing a container, because it is always dependent on a layer above, a layer below, depending on, you know, where you're deploying it, how you're deploying it, where you are, you know, where your source is coming from, be it a library, be it anything, right? So it involves like regular container security best practices all the way from, you know, choosing a base image, and, you know, how are you managing your dependencies? Are you creating, are you having SCAs? Are you checking open source packages? Are you creating SBOMs to check? You know, basically, are you creating that breakdown of the whole application and understanding what are the different vulnerabilities of all these libraries? And what checks do you have at CI and CD level? Like, are you signing your layers, you know? Are you basically trying to validate maybe the supply chain aspect of it, right? Are you trying to validate where these direct libraries or even transient dependencies are coming from? Who's doing the code review, these branch protection rules, and all the CI and CD aspects of it? And maybe coming to the runtime while deploying, do you have admission controllers deployed where are you checking the, you know, if the right kind of base image is being used? I mean, the whitelisted base images are being used or not. And then are you trying to pull an image out of the scope, out of the defined scope? Maybe you told that, hey, just pull from this ECR and you're trying to pull from Docker Hub. Is that allowed? And coming to runtime, maybe, you know, network policies of pods, what pods can talk to what? And are you letting, you know, what user you're running the container with? And, you know, something like, you know, the network calls a container can make, maybe, you know, are you letting people exec into the container, or you're letting them debug using kubectl debug or creating a temporary pod? Or, you know, and the coming to the runtime, again, so the monitoring part, how are you monitoring these containers? Like, well, like you have followed all the best practices, but there's an application running on the container and somebody exploits it through layer 7. Somebody does an SQLI, or somebody got a command injection or XSS. Are you monitoring it? Is there WAF? So if there's no WAF, what are you doing about it? So yeah, I think these are all the best practices you should be following, not just specific to containers, but all the layers have specified, which are interdependent with the container layers. Yep.
Most of the tools and practices we discussed were around base images and protecting against runtime vulnerabilities. However, at the same time, container images are an interesting attack vector from a supply chain perspective. While your article doesn't necessarily cover this, we would like to know your opinion on this subject. What do you think?
I think most of these things are, the indirect attack surface area. The way we used to see this attack surface area was always solely focused on the perimeter or internet tracing assets, right? I think right now, because there's a lot of sophistication already in the internet, in the internet tracing layer. You have WAFs, you have like very smart WAFs, you have adaptive WAFs where they fine tune their rules on the go using machine learning algorithms. So the attacker is also having hard time. So he's trying to find certain ways to inject things into the system through unusual ways. So we arrive at supply chain, right? So he tries to identify, what are the transient dependencies. If he could, he could inject, we've seen the recent attack as well, right? So, and if you could pull that off, he could basically get into the system without basically trying any reverse shells, nothing, right? He could just get into the system and persist his access through a single library or an injection from the supply chain world. So what's important here is you signing your artifacts. You know, you can use cosign or something where it's not just library, you should be signing layers, signing your image layers. And when there's a multi-stage build, we end up scanning the final build. But what if there's a transient dependency in any of the layer which is before the final build? So how are we covering that? And I think, again, coming back to the runtime part, you should have, right now, Kyber No, if you look at that, there are like great policies out there, both written by community and which are pre-existing, even in the supply chain area where it checks what, you know, is it the signed image, where the source is it like a known source or not, what are the kind of base images are you using, are you trying to bypass something? So you can even write a lot of custom policies using Kyber No. So in the supply chain aspect, mostly we can look at these aspects. So
now you write a lot, apart from the blog that we've spoken about today's episode. What motivates you to share your knowledge? It takes time.
Yeah, it is. Like I told in the start, I think it's kind of most of the things we learned. I mean, I think it's 99% of the things we learned are always from the community. And it's whether it is YouTube, whether it is Stanford CS50 or, you know, some Stack Overflow, whatever it is, right? It's mostly community, right? So I think if you think you know something really well, I think that's the best way to give back to the community. One, two, it's a very good reminder and a validation of what all you've been learning, right? In the last how many ever years you were in the industry. So, you know, the kind of reminders I get, like, hey, these are all the things you had learned in the past, I think that makes me write. Or even recently, yeah, I've been talking also on these kinds of podcasts. So, yep.
We found an old LinkedIn post of yours, actually, where you made the case that sharing your knowledge is better than gaining certifications. Do you still believe that?
Yeah, I always believe that, because I'm not a big fan of certifications. Because, I mean, one thing is, see, the ratio of certs to courses is, you buy one course, you get 10 courses. Sorry, you get a one cert at the same price, you get 10 or 20 courses in the same price, right? That's not just, it's just not that. But courses, see, basically the system of certifications is that I have to prove you that I know something, right? And we very well know that certification systems are broken. It's right now, if you see that, hey, I'm a CEH, I'm an OSCP or whatever, you don't need to basically, you can't vouch and tell that I have certain skill set just by looking at my certificate, right? Instead of that, if I can prove by writing that, by talking about it, by helping others, I think that's a great way to show what you know. At the same time, it helps the community as well. And in fact, one of the old interviews which I was part of, the one who was taking the interview had read my article on why SSH proxy forwarding is a bad idea on Medium. And he recognized that it was me. So that has a different kind of impact, is what I feel, versus a guy who holds like 10 certs and puts it on LinkedIn or whatever. So yeah, I think there are also mandatory rules from companies that, hey, you'll have to do these certs. It's okay, you do it as long as the company is paying for it. But I mean, you spending like, you know, thousands of dollars on certs, I'm not a big fan of. So yeah.
You, in addition to writing, you also have your own podcast. Tell me what it's about. What's the name? How can people find it?
Right. I've recently started a podcast called Kernel Space. I mean, I wanted to start it since, you know, like 2 years or so. But yeah, never pulled it off. But I just started it, and it's mostly conversations with maybe CISOs or any of the security founders or security researchers. Basically, try to network with them and understand certain aspects which are less spoken about, right? And I mean, in simple, that is all the podcast is all about. So, yep.
Very good.
I also found out you're going to be speaking at Black Hat USA 2024. What's the topic going to be?
Right. So we have built a tool, me and my colleague Anand, we built a tool called, it's called Cobra. It's Cloud Offensive Breach and Risk Assessment Tool. So it basically simulates multi-staged attack paths. For example, we've seen a lot of attacks where attacker gets into a system and does a lot of things, escalating its privileges, accessing data, persistence, like the Mitre framework, right? So it exactly focuses on the cloud native environment. As an example, a web application gets exploited, attacker gets into the port, accesses SCADA secrets, cluster takeover, and then, you know, he gets into the node and takes over the role. Then maybe account takeover, right? These are all the chained attacks which are happening. So we just want to build a simulation tool around this where you can use this to maybe evaluate CNAPs. For example, if you're doing a CNAP POC, you just go and deploy 3 or 4 attacks from GCP, AWS, Azure, and KTS, and see if they're able to detect this, see what controls you have in place already, right? So this is the tool. It got selected in Black Hat Arsenal and also DEF CON demo day in Cloud Village. So, yep, excited to be there and present this.
What's next for you? Apart from the podcasting and speaking of Black Hat, anything else?
I'm basically focusing on certain aspects of research where I'm trying to see, like I told one use case where can you basically steal a etcd pod and try to access secrets from it, and, you know, try to put something in etcd and bypass admission controller. Just trying to experiment on a few things. And apart from that, it's general security stuff, and I'm trying to build a community, also a security community on Discord. We are, I think, 50 people now. Just a couple of people who are, like, you know, very active. So, yep, these are the couple of things I'm doing these days.
If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do it?
LinkedIn. I think I'm active on LinkedIn, and I also do TopMint. TopMint is like a one-on-one, you know, mentor-mentee platform where I do it for free. It's just for basically expand my network and talk to great people. Let's say if I don't know something, I learn from them. They don't know something, they need help, I basically go there. And so, yeah, there are, I keep doing this TopMint stuff. It's been a year or so.
Fantastic. Well, Harsha, thank you so much for your generosity regarding your time and how you're sharing your knowledge. I'm sure you'll be inspiring others to do the same thing. We'll be looking out for the next things that you'll be sharing about security. In the meantime, take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Cheers.